Welcome back to the Daily Drum on 96.3 WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Bramante Bryant, in for Harold Fisher. This is the Insight segment. Well, as we all know, these are tenuous times in our nation. Two major issues, though, taking place at one time. Protests in the streets demanding changes to policing in America. And at the same time, COVID-19 still with a strong impact as cases in some parts of the country still on the rise. Through it all, reporters are out there on the front lines, gathering information, trying to protect themselves against COVID-19, as well as tear gas, rubber bullets, and projectiles. Tonight, they're here to talk about their experiences and what we should know is happening in front and behind the lines. The phone lines are open, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We'd like you to be part of the conversation with your questions or comments. Joining us tonight is Charisse May. She's a photojournalist with the New York Times and president of Women Photojournalists of Washington and an adjunct professor at Howard University. And Michael Quander, he is a reporter, an award-winning reporter with WUSA right here in the district. And joining us a little later is Troy Johnson, news anchor with Channel 16 WPT in Jackson, Mississippi. Again, the phone lines are open, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Charisse and Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to join us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
All right, we're going to start with you, Charisse. Ladies first, tell us about the challenges that you are facing out there trying to cover really two pandemics right now.
Right. So first of all, a point of clarity. I've been shooting protests for the New York Times, but I'm actually a freelance journalist.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. We're in the middle of two pandemics. And this time, though, feels different, even in the midst of the global coronavirus pandemic. It's different in that the youth are taking the lead with these current protests that are going on. And they're highly organized, they're fully engaged, and they have no fear. And what I've seen as well is there are more white people who have joined in with this protest as I've been out there. All ages, it skews on the younger side, but I have seen older people out there as well. And that's been something different I've seen than any other protests or rallies or movements that I've covered.
And how do you think, Charisse, that's changing the movement for what you see? When you say youth taking the lead, more whites are out there and older people. Do you think that's affected the protests in a certain way?
Oh, it definitely has. It definitely has. It seems to be gathering like stronger traction.
Mm-hmm.
And since we are in the middle of the coronavirus global pandemic, people have nothing but time on their hands to dedicate to the protest. You know, a lot of people are out of work and, you know, they put their mask on. Majority of people out there I saw had their mask on. So people are still aware of the coronavirus out there, but that hasn't stopped them from coming out. And it's just the seeing so many more white people out there is what really caused me to look again, like, okay, this feels different. You know, there are families out here and there are a lot of white youth out there who are strong. They're strongly voicing their allyship.
Yeah, and I'm sorry. Go right ahead, Charisse.
No, I was just saying I haven't seen that before.
And Michael, you know, Charisse brings up a good point because I've got to tell you, I was covering the protest on Saturday or Sunday. I think it was Saturday. Mm-hmm. I lost track of what day I was out there. Saturday. And at the same time, my family had come out with me, right? My two kids and my wife. And so we were out there and I was covering at the same time. So I was splitting off. So I'm one of those that Charisse is talking about having families out there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a different feel. Michael, what would you say about that, and what challenges have you had to face being out there on the front lines?
Yeah, Vermont, the first thing I have to say is 2020 has been a crazy year, to say the least. you know, dealing with some very serious issues. You know, one of the things that did stick out to me was that we know that just before all of this happened with George Floyd, we were under stay-at-home orders, people staying 6 feet away. At no point did you think you would have thousands of people shoulder to shoulder protesting about an issue. And I think that speaks to just how important everyone that has been out there felt like this was. The fact that they were willing to literally put their lives on the line in order to call for justice amongst these several issues. And so I have seen the families. I think one thing that stuck out to me so much is seeing the Black moms or the interracial families with young Black children and speaking to them. And as young as 3 and 5 years old, parents are already having a difficult conversation about what it means to be a Black person living in this country and the things to look out for, the conversations to have and not to have, and to prepare them for what may or may not come. But to the point of families being out there, though, I think that people are really hopeful that they are out there and that these young people hopefully won't have to go through what Black people in this country have went through for years.
And I must say, again, I've got 2 teenage kids, so we've had to have that conversation. And when I was out there on 16th Street, I got to tell you, and I don't know how you two feel about this, but I, you know, I'd been to some protests just covering them as a reporter. I was amazed at the walking around with just all of these bottles of water. They were giving away chips, cookies. My son took home a sandwich. I don't even know when he grabbed that. And all of it was free. And it sounds like a small thing, but to me, it was so large in what it said, because as we all know, that we've seen those opportunities where business folks say, oh, wait a minute, I can make some money here. Now, we saw trucks there selling stuff. But there was a lot of stuff, you know, that you were giving away. So, Charisse, did that strike you at all as something different that you had seen before? I have to say, I really hadn't seen that before. Am I overplaying that?
No. That is something different, because other protests that I've covered, I've never seen that. It's always been vendors who are selling snacks and water.
Exactly.
But this time, and that goes to what I was saying earlier in terms of the youth who are taking the lead for this, the Black Lives Matter organization and other organizations that have joined in. They had they had medic teams. They had their vest on, identifying themselves, had the first aid. They had masks to give out to people that didn't have masks. They had people giving out, you know, free water and Gatorade and snacks everywhere around the city downtown. Like, everywhere you'd step, there was like a table with, you know, water. It was like free water, free snacks. You know, they were checking on people. And that's something I've never seen done, you know, at a protest.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tonight we're talking with journalists on the front line covering two pandemics at the same time. They really are coalescing together, because as folks are out there protesting in the street, they're right on each other. Some are wearing masks. I would say most that I see are wearing masks, but some aren't. And it's kind of running counter to what health officials are saying about not being in close contact. So with that, Michael Quander, how do you protect yourself? Because I put it in sort of two categories. Not only are you trying to protect your health in terms of the COVID virus, but you have to protect yourself in terms of what may come flying from a projectile, from a protester possibly, or if things get dicey, what the police may have to do. So are you concerned about that? And if so, how do you handle how you have to cover these stories while at the same time sort of keeping in your head you've kind of got to watch out for danger zones?
This is a really good question, because I would say both of those worlds collided very quickly. Mm-hmm. I know that before the protests began, you know, as a station, I work at WUSA 9 on Get Up DC there, and we were not coming into the building. We were doing everything remotely, even live shots from home. I was doing all of my interviews over Skype and Zoom. We were doing as much as we could to not only protect ourselves, but just protect our families and to protect the public from spreading COVID-19. And we had a strict no in-person interview rule unless it called for extreme circumstances. And I have to tell you, those extreme circumstances hit right away when we saw those protests happening. And what are you going to do as a journalist? Are you going to, you can't do that story from home. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it came with time where us as journalists, we had to say, you know, we have a job to do. And we can do what we can do to protect ourselves. But these stories need to be told. And I think that there was a sense of protecting yourself as much as you can. So, you know, we do as much as we can. We wear masks. A lot of us work with the same crew instead of switching out photographers and reporters. A lot of us work together. And still, you know, while we're riding in cars, we try to keep our distance. But I got to tell you, when you're out there at these protests and the music is going and people are, you're marching with the crowd, you know, there's not but so much you can do as far as social distance is concerned.
Right.
But you can try to do your best when you get back home and kind of like take everything down. But one of the things that stood out to me, too, was that I had it didn't happen to me, but, you know, I had several colleagues who in the early days of the protest here in D.C. were hit with tear gas and things like that. And that was something that they didn't prepare for or expect beforehand. And it's something that they had to deal with. And since then, we've kind of armed ourselves with some stuff. But these things have seemed to calm down now, too.
And we've seen the MSNBC anchor and reporter, Ali Velshi, I think, was hit with one of those rubber bullets. Mm-hmm. And a CNN photographer or reporter, I can't remember which, I think also was struck during the protest. Mm-hmm. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Phone lines are open. We're talking tonight with reporter Michael Quander, an award-winning reporter with WUSA-TV here in the district, and Charisse May, president of the Women's Photojournalists of Washington, an adjunct professor at Howard University, and a freelance photojournalist with the New York Times. You both are African-American journalists. You're out there covering protests that really are generated by the death of George Floyd and others, African-Americans who have died at the hands of police. And still, as we mentioned, during this COVID-19 crisis that is disproportionately affecting African-Americans. So as you head into sort of the throngs of this, where does your sort of African-Americanism mm-hmm. fall into this? Or do you have to suspend that? Or can you? Charisse, I'll let you attack that one first.
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked that. What I can say is I'm a black woman first before I put my credential on.
Okay.
That's number one. That's not going to change. That's an all I do. That's a part of me. So it's interesting because there's this movement of white photographers advocating for black photojournalists to tell this story, mm-hmm. to be in the forefront.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been this whole, like, interesting. It's been this whole campaign where white photographers are starting to share our work. They're reaching out to editors saying, hire them. They're reaching out to editors saying, license photos directly from us. As a black woman covering this, I've had my own personal experiences with racism and police harassment. I feel like I can tell the story with the sensitivity to the core of the issues and a respect for those issues and the cause.
Mm-hmm.
For me, this isn't a one-off opportunity to come out with some award-winning photos. I'm not looking to exploit trauma. What I'm looking to do is to tell the story. I feel I have the responsibility to tell that story and to tell it with dignity and respect.
Michael Quander, I have seen your work, your personalized work on your family history. So you've played the role of reporter and historian. So we know you're an African-American, but you've had to dig deep into your own family history. And so when you're out there covering these stories, you know, what you've learned, what you know, and you're bearing just as everybody sees when you show up at a protest or covering the COVID-19 pandemic, how does your life experiences affect how you're covering these stories?
Yeah, you know, I come from a interesting position. The Quander family is one of the oldest documented families in this country, a really strong documented black families, excuse me, in this country. And we have a strong sense of resiliency and pride in that. And for me, you know, I think as a journalist, sometimes we go in and cover stories and kind of it's easy for us to kind of be down the middle about things and to be able to kind of just to deliver the story without mm-hmm. getting the personal emotions involved at times. For me, this has been completely different. I've broken down in tears, mistakenly on Instagram Live when I was just trying to process everything. And that was jarring to me because I don't remember a time where I felt that personally involved in a story as I do now. I think it's seeing all of the images and seeing that video of George Floyd, for instance, and, you know, he looks like a cousin or an uncle that I may have, correct? Mm-hmm, and, mm-hmm. and I think that for me, that's where it has become emotional to deal with. And so, you know, thankfully, I do work for a station that understands that and is being proactive about that and making sure that we are telling a story from our personal point of view, right? And I think the viewers so far have embraced that. I remember over the weekend, I had the task of marching down with the Mochella, like the Don't Mute DC movement. Mm-hmm. They had a go-go band marching down U Street and down 16th and then into Black Lives Matter Plaza. And there was a sense of pride almost that I felt even covering that story, listening to people, getting how they truly feel out there, people who felt like they didn't have a voice at one point,
right.
giving them a voice and amplifying that on TV, but then also be surrounded by go-go music, which is, you know, a music that is just native to D.C.
Right.
It's Black, you know, and it's a part of what Chocolate City is, and it was a certain sense of pride in covering that and also being able to be a voice for the people of my city who felt like they didn't have one.
Because definitely Saturday when I was down there, the go-go was playing, the mayor showed up, my daughter was out there in the middle. I don't know if she was on the A or the C of Black Lives Matter on 16th Street, but it was really fascinating to see all of that. And in many ways, it is not what you would think of when you think of a protest, right? Mm-hmm. But it still all was kind of part where it seemed seamless, where it worked together. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Nicole, I want to make sure I get you on the line before we jump over to the other side, but I don't think I'm going to make it. So, Nicole,
that's okay.
Stay right there. I'm going to get you. We just have to sort of take a quick break, and then we're going to jump right back. But before we go, I want to thank Charisse May, who's going to have to leave us. Thank you so much for joining us, Charisse, and best of luck for everything that you're doing out there.
Thank you.
In terms of covering this. Michael Quander is going to stay with us, and when we come back, awesome. Troy Johnson is going to join us. So again, if you're on the line, stay right there. We'll get to you. We'll continue on SiriusXM channel 141. The phone lines are still open, 202-319-7810. I'm Bramante Bryant, in for Harold Fisher. The original Quiet Storm is next on 96.3 WHUR. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on HUR Voices, SiriusXM channel 141. I'm Bramante Bryant, in for Harold Fisher. This is the Insight segment. Tonight, we're talking with reporters about their experiences on the front lines, covering not one, but two pandemics. Yes, pandemic has been referred to COVID-19, but literally it is and figuratively, it is a pandemic of what is going on in our nation now. Protest out in the streets regarding the police taking the lives of unarmed Black men and women. And what's it like for those reporters who are out there covering that? We're talking about that tonight. We'd like you to join the conversation. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Joining us tonight is Michael Quander, an award-winning reporter with WUSA 9 here in Washington, D.C., and Troy Johnson, news anchor and reporter with WPT Channel 16 in Jackson, Mississippi, and a friend to this show, and WHUR. Michael, thank you for staying with us. And Troy, good to hear you. I can't see you, but thank you for being with us. Long time no talk to.
Good to talk to you, man. And just a point of note,
yes.
WAPT.
You know what?
Got to get my call letters right.
They corrected me on that, and I still got it wrong. I should know that, having to get call letters right. But thank you, Troy. I know it comes with love. Before we get to our two reporters, I did say I wanted to get back to Nicole, who was waiting patiently on the line calling from D.C., and she wanted to have her question or comment addressed or presented. Go right ahead, Nicole.
Thank you. You know what? I'm a Ph.D. in racism strategy, so I research extensively racism in policies against African-American males in secondary education. So So I'm from Compton. I was about 12 when Rodney King had happened. My brother and I were there. I moved to D.C. for Michael Brown and Trayvon Martin and all, you know. Then I was teaching kids with Freddie Gray, and now this. A completely different narrative, a completely different narrative, because it's a collective of people that are tired and exhausted, and it's a collective of people that watched a nine-minute video of someone that did not care, and someone that's knee, that whose knee was on someone's neck and saw him die right before their very eyes. And so what happened now, you see people doing, they're taking a turn and really taking responsibility and accountability for privileged and for policies and policings and politics in policings that have caused this behavior among, you know, those men in Minneapolis.
Yeah, Nicole, let me ask you. I think the concern for many, right, and if you've lived long enough, you've seen these things. I mean, I can, let's see, what can I tie to clearly? I mean, I was born during the King riots, but I was little, so I don't really remember. So my you know, goes to the riots in 92 in L.A. We saw the police violence against Rodney King. We thought there may be some changes. You know, they didn't come. And so what's your sense of, I know you said it's different. The protests are different, but does different also mean you see systemic change possibly coming?
This is the thing, and I spoke at the riots to a group of about 200 people, and what I did say is we have been so dependent upon systems of rotation for so long that it's time for us to evolve. And based on the group that I spoke to, with Black Lives Matter and a few people, and the people that were there, I said, you have the thumbprint. Everyone has their own personal thumbprint to create change right where you are, to create change. So it's a responsibility, as I tell people all the time. You have to take accountability and responsibility. Do you want equity? My main key that I always speak about, I always talk about, is equity. Do you want equity? And so the difference of, I think this time is you see a lot more. I mean, there were so many white students that I have taught and that I've been with, and there were white kids there asking, what do we do? How do we integrate? I've had friends who I've known for years in South Carolina who are now saying, this is enough. What do I do? And so we have to create a narrative, African-American people, people in journalism, people who are, you know, professors and educators. We have to create a real truthful narrative and say, this is what you can do. And we need to create a strategy. The one thing that was missing, you had a full pool of people there. And it was kind of emotional, which it was, and emotionalized, but no one had a final strategy. Okay, stand next to the person next to them. You don't have to live with them, but you need to get their IG. And then you need to create a chain. Who are the teachers? Who are the doctors? Who are the this? Who are the that? And start creating those narratives of truthful, truthfulness in politics. I tell people all the time, don't vote emotionally. Don't vote you know, from your family heritage. Vote for the person you think is going to do the best job.
Well, thank you so much, Nicole. You gave us lot sort of to chew on. We appreciate your call. Troy Johnson, thank you so much. You're down there. Is it down? Because, you know, I know nothing about directions. Are you down there in Mississippi or up? What is that? Wait a minute. You're down.
Down here, right? In Mississippi.
Down in Mississippi, Mavis Staples. That's a great song, by the way. Troy, tell us about what you're experiencing, because you're in the heart right of the South. Jackson, Mississippi, are your experiences, you believe, different in terms of covering COVID-19, covering the protests? What are you seeing? What are your challenges that you're facing?
Well, you know, my experiences here are, of course, shaped, and I approach them based on many of the things that I covered when I was working at WHUR. You know, one of the last things I remember, one of the last protests I remember covering for the station was when a group of white supremacists were at the White House, and there were Antifa groups showing up. This was 2018, I believe. So, you know, I remember covering and reporting on Freddie Gray when I was doing stuff for NBC4 with our, you know, our stuff with WHUR. So, you know, I brought that experience down here, and I have to say that the things that you're seeing in Washington, D.C., and Minneapolis, on the West Coast as well are happening here too.
With the same intensity, Troy?
With the same level of intensity. There have been rallies in small towns, protests in small towns around Mississippi, but also in larger areas like Hattiesburg and Vicksburg. And in Jackson on Saturday, probably the largest of all of the events that were here. And it was the thing that I heard you guys talking about earlier was that this was youth-driven.
Mm-hmm.
Black Lives Matter, Mississippi, and the bulk of the core group that put this event together in 5 days are college students. One of them, I know for sure, she's 18, hasn't even started her freshman year at North Carolina A&T yet. So you have, kind of the same strategic planning that you have in Washington, D.C. in terms of PPE was on hand. There were water and snacks. I heard you guys talking about that there. That happened here, too.
Mm-hmm.
And they also came away with, a manifesto of sorts. What are we going to do next? They were taking issue with the mayor of a town here in Mississippi, Petal, Mississippi. The story got some national attention. He had some disparaging remarks about George Floyd after his death, and there have been protests in that town. There has been essentially a rebuke from the town council about what he had to say. He's refused to resign.
And that was my next question for you, Troy, too. I was wondering what the reaction, because listen, every area has stereotypes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Every area has a history that it's hard to ignore. And when you hear Mississippi, right, and you hear Black Lives Matter, some folks, Black Lives Matter in the streets, what's local officials doing about that? And so that was my next question. But hold that thought, Troy, because I want you to sort of pick up on that. I just want to give the phone number out again. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I'm going to bounce back to Troy real quick. But, Michael, I did want to ask you this about the COVID-19, and it may sound like a silly question, but I know when I was out at the protest in D.C. on Saturday, I will say you got to keep up with the marchers, right? You got to be walking. You got to be covering. And you got that mask on your face. And that actually did affect how I was moving around. A couple of times I had to walk away, catch my breath, pull the mask down. Does that affect you at all in how you're covering and what you're covering? Because we see it now. You can turn on the national news, and those reporters, they don't even pull them down now when they do their stand-ups and their reports. How is it? Does that affect your reporting at all and how you move about?
You know, it can. I think also, like, first of all, learning how to talk in the mask. And then a lot of what we do as reporters on the scene, you know, we are out there talking to people and connecting with people. And sometimes you think about a barrier being in between that connection. So part of times like facial expressions and body language, a lot of times we kind of go off with those things. So for me, it's been a little bit more difficult sometimes, like having a true connection and while having a conversation, making sure that someone that I'm speaking with truly sees the sincerity in my face of making sure that they feel comfortable sharing their story. But then also, too, obviously we don't want to make ourselves sick, our family sick, or pass anything on to someone else that we're speaking to. So, at this protest, some of that, unfortunately, like the social distancing had to go out the window because, we're in tight quarters. We are talking close to each other, and the masks are only somewhat effective in that close range. So, some of it is a risk, I guess, that you take, but someone said it perfectly at the protest that I spoke with, saying that it's a calculated risk that they're willing to take, and it's a risk that they really felt like they could not avoid because this cause was just that important to them that they were literally putting their lives potentially on the line being out there to protest.
Yeah. And Troy, I know that you sort of were locked down in your home for a while, right? Doing reports, doing some anchoring. I know you got out and tried to walk around a little bit to get out and do some movement. So I want you to talk a little bit about that, but finish your point about, number one, the reaction of local officials to the protest, right, out in the streets, and how you've had to sort of deal with covering both of these things and trying to be sure that, you stay safe on all fronts.
Right. Well, this rally that happened in Jackson, the point of gathering was directly in front of the governor's mansion.
Hmm.
So Governor Tate Reeves, I don't know if he was in the House or not, but he certainly got an earful of everything from Public Enemy to
Public Enemy.
Okay. Yeah, oh yeah, it was in full of. I actually wanted the playlist. It was amazing.
Music. The old DJ that you are.
You know, it was
Music Man.
It was definitely turned up, as they would say. But you know, that was a part of what these young people, again, driving this protest, this demonstration, wanted to be. They wanted their voices to be heard. They wanted the music that you know, inspires them to protest. They wanted that to be there as well. So again, at the seat of one of the seats of the Confederacy, right?
Yes.
At the governor's mansion, mm-hmm. in a state that is red, in a state that flies the only flag in America that has a Confederate symbol on it. You know, mm-hmm. all of those things were, you know, as I said, there was kind of a manifesto after this thing was over with. And today, the conversation with the governor's COVID-19 briefing was dominated by conversations about the flag and taking the flag down.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, is he willing to do it? You know, he was unwilling, actually, in the press conference to give his own personal opinion of the flag that's flying over the governor's mansion. So he was talking about pushing it towards citizens to have a referendum to vote on it rather than him taking action or having the legislature take action. So, you know, we started with, you know, police brutality, equality, and now you have these other issues with, you know, holding elected officials accountable, changing our state flag. All of those things are now in. They're in the whole dynamic,
right.
And all are up for question, and it's because of these kinds of protests.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not going away. My my story tonight at 10 o'clock is going to be not about COVID-19, but it's going to be around the governor's reaction to the flag, and I'm going to talk to a state senator. I'm going to talk to a person who's designed an alternate version. So, you know, these conversations are going to continue to happen, and, you know, as has been said earlier, you know, people made a conscious decision to mask up and get out in a group of people and have their voices heard in the middle of a pandemic.
Right.
Today in the state of Mississippi, they reported nearly 500 new cases of COVID-19.
Wow.
And that, again, if you trace that back to 2 weeks ago, that's roughly Memorial Day. So here it's 200 to 300 cases per day. That's kind of the average. But now we see this first spike with 500. And they're about, I think they're about 860 deaths so far.
Yeah, we're going to continue to see that. And I know the CDC and health officials are concerned about that as an offshoot of these protests, that those numbers are going to spike when they come back. So we're going to continue to talk about that, covering COVID-19, covering the protest and what reporters have to face, especially African-American reporters. And we're going to sort of dive into that a little bit more with our guests. We're going to take a quick break, though. We'll be right back. This is the Insight segment on SiriusXM Channel 141. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on HRR Voices, SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Bramante Bryant in for Harold Fisher. This is the Insight segment. Tonight, our focus is on the two pandemics, I would call it, going on in this country today. The protests regarding police brutality and how police are dealing with African-American men and women in their interactions with them and the deadly consequences all too often from that. And COVID-19, which has kind of gone on the back burner a bit, but is really walking side by side, is literally when we're dealing with protests and folks wearing masks. Our phone lines are open. We want to hear from you. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are joined tonight. Our guest is Michael Quander. He is an award-winning reporter with WUSA Channel 9 right here in D.C. And Troy Johnson, news anchor and reporter with WAPT, Channel 16 in Jackson, Mississippi. Michael, I wanted to ask this, and I think you kind of alluded to it a little bit earlier when we were talking about the newsroom and the support that you were getting from your newsroom. Talk a little bit about that, like the conversations that are being had, because often, especially in the past, you know, there weren't as many African-Americans in newsrooms, and that's still an issue where we need more. But are you finding where your input is more solicited, or are you looked at just another reporter going out there covering the story like any other? Is that what's coming at you, or do you get a sense that they kind of want to know what you think, how you may feel what's happening as an African-American male?
Very good question. Excuse me. You know, I've worked in several newsrooms so far, and by far, I think after our station did some rebranding and really took a pulse of the culture at the station, how things were going, the culture has shifted so much, and I don't know how things were before, but I will say that one of our core values is diversity of voices, and I do feel like my voice matters. I think for me, being in a newsroom and being in a city where we have a lot of transplants that move here, for me being a D.C. native and a Black man, and with my own life experiences, a lot of that stuff does influence the way that I'm able to influence, I guess, coverage, I guess, in a way, or fight for certain stories. And so with this particular, I think one of the things I was really proud of, number one, on Saturday, you know, we were the only station to do extended coverage. And then the two people on the desk back at the news station were two Black men, both from the DMV, anchoring this newscast. And so, you know, I think that they understand the culture of D.C., the history of D.C., and I really do feel like that my voice, when it comes to news coverage, is definitely respected in that sense.
And Troy, talk a little bit about that. I'm not sure the makeup of your station and sort of where you fit in terms of the numbers, right, of people of color. Right. But do you feel that either they're coming to you, you have to speak up more, or is it just kind of sort of a natural flow in how you all are approaching the stories? What's your take on your sort of your newsroom and the sense of what's how you're moving forward with that?
Right. Well, fortunately, there are Black voices in our newsroom. We have several African-American producers. Our assistant news director is Black. Our chief photographer and many of our photogs are Black. So there are quite a few folks that, you know, I know you both, as we all are African-American men here, you know, you can look at each other like, I got this. I look over, you got this? Yeah, we got it. I mean, you don't have to have a full presentation of what we're going to do tonight. Like with my story tonight, I'm like, this is what we're going to do. Now, again, you know, part of that is being an anchor as well as a reporter for me. Right. You know, I've got a little bit of gravitas, a little bit, not much. Mm-hmm. But it also starts with, you know, a general manager who you know, is reading the tea leaves and what's going on as well. You know, we're striving to be on top of a variety of stories. You know, tonight we're talking about COVID-19 and we're talking about these protests, but Cristobal just kind of rolled through here. Could have been worse than expected. And it's hurricane season. We've got to cover the same veracity that we would cover a story like a potentially life-threatening hurricane. I believe we have to approach this pandemic in terms of inequality and police brutality, but inequality in America is a pandemic that's 400 years old for Black people.
Right.
So we need to have that same kind of veracity, and that's where you test your newsroom. You know, in the coming months, if these stories begin to go on the back burner, that's where we have to speak up.
Right.
And we have to say that, you know, hey, you know, we didn't just go out here and go to all these marches and you know, listen to these voices to just shelve it because it's the second round of COVID-19.
Right.
You know, we have to now it's easy to use our voices because all eyes are on an issue that we are all intimately familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
But we have, you know, the real test is what are we going to do in September? What are we going to do in October? I hope that we have that same kind of, you know, that same kind of voice amplified in the newsroom when it's important.
Yeah. Have you, I don't know if you guys have seen this story that came out from Pittsburgh with the Pittsburgh
Courier Gazette,
mm-hmm. Where the union had to sort of come in and support an African-American reporter where the paper took her off of covering the protest because I think she had put something on Twitter where she was showing a picture of, I think maybe a Kenny Chesney concert, and you just saw a mass of confusion. A bunch of stuff was torn up, and she says, "Oh, what is this? A protest? Oh, no, no, you know, the Black Lives Matter protest. No, it's a Kenny Chesney concert." And so, the editorial staff, the editor, took her off, saying, "Well, we think you may have a bias in sort of how you've covered this." And now you've had local politicians in Pittsburgh come to her defense. And so, I'll come to you, Michael. I don't know if you're familiar with that story, but do you feel a certain pressure on how you're covering these stories today, whether it's about COVID-19 in the African-American community or Black Lives Matter or the protests? Do you feel a certain amount of weight when you go out to cover these kinds of stories?
I do. And I think that that weight for me comes from the community that I'm a part of. I think that I look at the Black people who watch our station or the Black people, especially reporting here in my hometown, the people who I know who are affected by all of these different issues. I think they look at me and they want me to do a good job in reporting the story fairly, but also being real about it too, right? So I tell people all the time, journalists, we are real people just like you. We have emotions and things like that. And I think it's important for us to not shy away from that sometimes, especially when it's an issue like this. At the end of the day, there's not really two sides to racism. You know, you have to call it out like it is, and we have to talk about that. Let's have some real conversations. And what you all were getting at earlier about newsrooms, not every single newsroom, to you all's point, is diverse. And I have encouraged my mentees and my other colleagues across the country that, you know, now is the time, even if you feel like your voice is minimal, you have a seat at the table. People out there are counting on us as journalists to deliver the news, to be their voices. And I think we have a job to do in that sense, and we can't shy away from it at this time.
And in our last few minutes, Troy, I wanted to ask you this because Michael and I are kind of in these different positions. Michael is a native of the Washington, D.C. area. Mm-hmm. I am technically a native of the Washington, D.C. area. I moved here when I was like two. And you're in an area now where you're coming in. You know, we're covering stories in our hometown.
Yeah.
You're coming in as an outsider. Has that sort of informed your approach to your stories and especially these two big stories in our last 2 minutes here?
Well, I have an asterisk, just like you have an asterisk of being a D.C. Native.
Mm-hmm.
I have an asterisk, too, because for me, you know, being here in Mississippi of all places, which, as we talked about earlier, some people have the stereotypical viewpoint of where it is and what it is. Part of me coming here is because my mother was born in Mississippi. My mother's side of the family is from here. And I have cousins that I do and don't know here. As a matter of fact, a few weeks ago, I went for the very first time in my whole life to a cemetery where my great-grandfather is buried. So, I knew.
So you've got the roots. It's in the blood.
It's in the blood, and I knew what the catfish was going to be like when I got
here. So, all right, so look, so when you come back this way, put it on some ice. And I don't know if they have any meat pies down there because my folks are from Louisiana, so bring some of those too. He is Troy Johnson, news anchor and reporter with WAPT Channel 16 in Jackson, Mississippi, and a beloved alum of WHUR 96.3. And he is Michael Quander, the award-winning reporter with WUSA 9 right here in D.C. And Michael, please say hello to Samara Ewing because I go way back with Channel 9. I was a reporter trainee there about 30 years ago. So
we
have that connection. Thank you both so much for joining us, and thanks for all our calls tonight. That's the Daily Drum for this Monday, June 8th. I'm Bramante Bryant in for Harold Fisher. Have a great night.